On the Richie Allen Show, lots of tweets on the vaccine thing. Samantha says, yeah, we're all doing our best for our children by not giving them this toxic crap. He's a proper F-wit, says Samantha, referring there to Will Moy from Full Fact. Let's welcome back to the programme, great friend of ours, brilliant journalist, the host of the Politics Show on BCFM in Bristol, which is unmissable, and also a veritable authority on Bilderberg. Check out bilderberg.org, thisweek.org.co.uk. Former BBC journalist Tony Gosling, welcome back to the programme. Thanks for gracing us with your presence. What sort of a summer are you having, T?
Thank you for your confidence in me, which is not shared by our mayor in Bristol, Marvin Rees, so-called Labour, who simply won't come on the programme. And I guess that maybe that's because he just thinks I'm a bad journalist. But it also, of course, it was pointed out in our programme last week that maybe it's just he doesn't like awkward questions. And, you know, weirdly, you just talking about vaccines, that was just the word I'd just written down, because I've done a little... Well, it's a very, very basic. It's just a couple of lines about just some real, real simple basic advice on vaccines. And that is, I don't think we should be totally against them, you know, 100%. But one of the basic things is if your doctor is telling you your child needs a vaccine or you need a vaccine, and then they're saying, well, we're going to need to combine this vaccine with a whole load of other things because this vaccine is so good and these other ones are so good that we're going to inject you with five or six vaccines all at once. There's just one thing to say to them, Gulf War Syndrome. And this is one of the things that caused a Gulf War Syndrome. Certainly that was the opinion of the people who suffered because of it. Obviously some died, but those that survived Gulf War Syndrome back in the 1990s, were absolutely adamant that it was because they were being injected with something like 6 or 7 or 8, 9 or 10 different things all at once, and their body, basically their immune system broke down, their body couldn't cope. And the same is true, of course, for an infant, a baby. So at the very least, I mean, nobody can really argue with this, Richie, is you say, well, I'm happy to have one vaccine, or I'm happy for you to give my child a vaccine, but don't you dare think about combining it with loads of other things. Well, give them one at a time. Let's not rush it, and let's not overload their ability to deal with these things. I mean, generally speaking, I'm anti. You know, I don't really think vaccines are a good idea unless you're going into a specific area and the vaccine is a good vaccine and it's a single vaccine. But, I mean, we're being bamboozled on a massive scale here, and we're being gaslighted as well, of course, by the BBC and the rest of them, saying, oh, you people are anti-vaxxers, you know, you're just vaccine deniers. And the actual truth is that we do need a proper public debate about this, which there simply hasn't been, because the drug companies, GlaxoSmithKline, Merck and the rest of them, have been lobbying so hard to get these vaccines as mandatory. And that's the horrific, I mean, this is what they're doing now in Germany, is they're saying if you don't get your kids vaccinated with this stuff, well, you're going to be fined and potentially jailed. So whose kids are they, by the way? Are they the state's property, or are they, you know, the loving parents that brought them into the world?
That's a whole other program, that. We might get into that sometime on the program. No, seriously, because that's a huge issue, that. Because we're seeing a steady encroaching on the rights of the family and the rights of parents to parent their children. I'm fascinated. See, I love having you on, Tone, because you never know where the conversation's going to go. It segues off into different areas. I'm fascinated by what's happened in Birmingham. I'm fascinated by what's happening in Birmingham. There you have parents, you know, it's amazing, the enemy of mine, enemy is my friend. You've got conservative Christians who would have despised Muslims, well, not despised them, but would have had nothing in common with them, kind of coming together to say, look, whatever, leave terms like homophobia to one side, leave all that nonsense to one side. We think the kids are too young at 4 to be asked to comprehend what are very, you know, serious issues, seriously personal issues, like their sexuality, like their gender identity. Leave them alone. And yet you've got the Minister for Education, it's changed, it's Gavin Williamson now, right? You've got these people, even Priti Patel has been speaking about this, saying, no, the state has decided that children must be told that this is good, this is good, this is good. And to hell with what the parents think. What do you think of that story? I think it's a big story, that.
It is. Yeah, of course, I think you should be definitely leaving this out of the curriculum for kids. They don't need to be taught about what is not normal sexuality, and I don't think they even really need to be taught about what is normal sexuality either at that age. Let's just leave the kids until they develop their own sexuality to do that. And what they're trying to do, of course, with this is to normalise what, for not just centuries, but for hundreds of tens of thousands of years, have been right across all the different faiths, right across the world, marriage has been between one person of one sex and one person of another sex. The idea that you can use the BBC and the secular government to change all that, to legislate, to say that marriage is no longer between one sex and the opposite sex, but it's between the same sexes, to me is laughable, Richie. And the idea that you can try and then tell infant school children, six, seven, even younger, that this is normal, when it's not, is just, to me, is preposterous. And I think most people listening to these debates will see the idiocy of it.
Yeah, I was tweeted by somebody who took offence at something I'd said, and it was a parent, actually, of a gay teenage kid, and sent me a tweet, and then blocked me, which I was really annoyed by, because I'm like, well, good that you tweeted me. You know, and you can come on the program and you can have a right good go at me because I've got thick skin and I'm not a bully. So you can come on. But tweeted at me saying, you know, it was hateful, and what if you had a son or a daughter? And my response was, the only time the school should intervene is if they see that there is clear discrimination, clear bullying or tormenting. So if you've got a child, you know, who's a bit effeminate, or a child who might be saying, you know, well, I think I might be gay or whatever like that, and then you've got other children interfering in that, that's when the school should get involved. Only then, and say to the antagonising child, listen, none of your business. We don't
now,
do that.
You probably remember the document Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars.
Oh, yes.
Which was touted around. I mean, you know, it's difficult to know the veracity of it, but what it was saying was pretty clear, is that we need to engage all women who have been, up until the 1960s when it was came out, or early 70s, mostly housewives. We need to get them all into work. Number one, because then they start having to pay tax, because when they're working at home, doing, you know, looking after the kids, etc., that's not being, it's not paid work and it's not tax work and it doesn't go into the GDP. But the other thing is that if we can persuade all these women to go out to work, then we can prize their children off them and start to educate them in big inverted commas and indoctrinate them the way we want to. Now, you know, you imagine how education very first started, you know, back in the Industrial Revolution, mainly around about that time, with, you know, formal schools being set up, and it took a lot of effort actually to prize the children off the parents and say, well, it's okay, you can give them a good Christian education, we'll bring them up in a very moral way. And eventually, slowly, after 100 years or so, parents got used to letting their kids go to school, and they trusted the people that were teaching them those values. But what's happened since, of course, is now everyone's got used to just giving up their kids to go to school and trusting the system, is that the state is now starting to intervene and saying, right, well, we want to program our young people to behave like this and to be like this. And I just think that over the years, it's a centuries-long project, Richie, that's prized the kids away from the parents, and the idea is that we want to press a few buttons, change a few policies, Michael Gove or whoever it happens to be, and program the kids up to be the way that we want them rather than the way the parents would.
Yeah. Yeah, hugely important issue that. Again, we could do a whole program on it. Tony Gosling is our guest, thisweek.org.uk, the host of the politics show at BCFM in Bristol. It is an outstanding program, folks. I know many of you who listen to this program are well aware of Tony and who he is.
Martin Summers is outstanding, Richie. I mean, he's extremely good. He's a former aid worker, worked in Bosnia. He's worked for Amnesty, worked for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development, doing all sorts of dirty tricks for them, and you might want to get him on to talk about that sometime. But Martin and I, yeah, we have a go each week, really, at you know, we also, obviously, with guests and well and live clips, in trying to get to the facts. And I've just literally heard this morning, I mean, the big thing that's going on at the moment, of course, is this tanker war. And the question is, what is Boris going to be doing? Because this is really the legacy that Jeremy Hunt has left for Boris. And it's probably, I think, the reason why Hunt was not included in Boris's new cabinet is because he's left in this awful problem of the seized tanker in Gibraltar. And the captain has come out the last day or so and explained, and I don't know if you covered this, Richie, that the legislation in Gibraltar was changed literally the day before the tanker was seized.
No way. No, I didn't know this, Tony. I didn't know. I have read today.
Unbelievable, isn't it? So they're saying in Gibraltar, oh, this is not a political act. We were just doing it because this tanker just happened to have violated the EU. Now, the EU sanctions, well, the EU don't care about the sanctions. The sanctions were to do with Syria from about 5-6 years ago, which was in a civil war. Well, it wasn't real civil war, but that's at least, you know, there was massive fighting going on right across Syria. Most of that has now been cleared up with the help of the Russians, Iranians, and everybody else that's intervened there. And so this is really history. I mean, this sanction regime doesn't really apply anymore because there's no need to have them. But they changed the laws in Gibraltar the day before to allow for this tanker seizure, which, by the way, was in international waters. And the captain has been spilling all, saying, well, these guys came onto my ship. They didn't even speak to me. They just basically elbowed me off the bridge, pointed guns in my face, and they wouldn't answer any questions. And then they steered the ship. And I think this shows to me that the Marines that did it knew that what they were doing was piracy. They just then simply steered the ship from international waters into Gibraltar waters, and that's where it was held. And of course, we've seen since that the Iranians have done a rather masterful move back, seizing a British ship and saying, well, you know, you can grab one of our ships, so we can grab one of yours. Where do you want this to end?
Yeah, but where might it end? You see, obviously, you'd be mad to surmise or to speculate any sort of ground invasion. That's not going to happen. But a bombing campaign against Iranian targets, a protracted one maybe, that's something that might happen. And I wouldn't imagine, and I'm certainly no military expert, far from it, but I wouldn't imagine that the Iranian government would take that lying down. And I would imagine that they would retaliate, and maybe retaliate against Israel. And where that ends, well, that ends in a world war, doesn't it?
Well, it also ends in, amazingly, and it sounds strange to say, but a victory for Netanyahu, because apparently this is one of the things he wants. He wants to have this sort of conflict so he can then be the strong guy, he can have political capital out of it, and he can be seen to be putting down the Persian hordes. The irony, of course, being that thousands of years ago it was actually Cyrus the Persian that charged across to Babylon and released the Jews from their captivity in Babylon. So this is the way they pay them back, is to try and start World War III, you know, with them. But also, of course, the big force in there is the Russians, and they're a major force, and the Chinese have backed to a certain extent the Iranians, but Russia is almost 100% backing them. And but domestically, what's going on, I think, has been fascinating over the last couple of days. This pillorying by Putin of Alexei Navalny's party over in Moscow. Now, Navalny's a really interesting character. I mean, he tweeted just last year, just before there was a horrendous, after the elections in Russia, there was a horrendous attack, or no, it wasn't an attack, it was a fire at a shopping centre in Kemerovo, in March last year. And just a few days before that, Navalny had tweeted, after these elections, keep a close eye on Kemerovo. You know, so was he involved in some sort? Did he know something that was going to happen there? Everyone afterwards said, well, I remember Navalny tweeting about that. The other thing about him is a lot of people have pointed to him as someone who's not necessarily taking money directly from the West in order to try and create some sort of Western-sponsored opposition party to Putin. But what he's doing is he's using the tactics that have been used in Ukraine and other places. In fact, it's a NATO playbook, basically, where, you know, what you're doing is you're pointing out specific things of corruption that are going on, which is fair enough, absolutely fine. But the thing is, you're taking your whole strategy and your backing from the West. I mean, we've got all these oligarchs that were tried to rape Russia in the 1990s. You know, there's Kolomoisky, Kordakovsky. Kolomoisky's now sponsoring, what's his name, Vladimir Bolensky in Russia, he's backed by one of these oligarchs that failed in their, well, they, to a certain extent, they made a lot of money, but then Putin kicked them out. So there's this whole, by taking over Russia in 2000 and in the early 2000s, Putin then got rid of most of these oligarchs who had been grabbing all of the infrastructure of Russia for virtually nothing, and they were trained up to do that, by the way, in Switzerland. And as these people got kicked out of Russia, so one by one they started to be a big thorn in the side of Putin, and they're the sort of people who are helping and sponsoring people like Navalny. So if you've got outside forces helping an opposition party, you've got foreign powers intervening to try and control the politics of Russia. Well, of course, the authorities in Russia are absolutely right to stop that kind of activity of that kind of political party. And I'm surprised he doesn't just simply close that down, because there are much better legitimate criticisms, mostly actually by the old Communist Party, of Putin, of corruption. And Navalny, it looks to me almost certain, as a, you know, someone who's very much associated with Yale University and the Okpor, that he's one of these people who's Western sponsored rather than a real domestic opposition. And I could totally understand Putin and the Russian establishment saying, well, we just simply cannot allow foreign powers to be organizing an uprising in Moscow. But if you go to it's a very different story over in Hong Kong, because that to me looks very much domestically run and domestically led, because, you know, you're getting literally millions of people in Hong Kong out on the streets, which Navalny simply can't do.
Yeah, this is really interesting, Tony. Again, we could go into that in even greater depth and be at it for a while. But I want to just stay with Israel, Iran, Russia, and Corbyn. Just a couple of quick points before you jump back in again. I'm very interested in the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu visits with Vladimir Putin fairly regularly. From what I can understand, as often as once every 5 or 6 weeks, or once every couple of months, and no minutes are taken. There's no briefing on what they discuss. This is true. A number of sources have endorsed this. So I want to get your thoughts on that. Before that, though, my feeling is that a lot of the anti-Semitism nonsense around the Labour Party is driven by a belief that if Jeremy Corbyn was leading a Labour government or a coalition government, that he would be some obstacle or some barrier to an assault on Iran, an aerial bombardment of Iran. I'm not saying that it's true. I'm not saying that Corbyn would be a genuine barrier. I mean, you know from talking to me a lot over the years that I don't regard or rate Jeremy Corbyn at all. I have no time for him. But I wonder how much of the anti-Semitism stuff, looking at Alistair Campbell on Sky News today talking to Kay Burley from a very wealthy home in Marseille, speaking to mass murderers and lawyers, talking about Corbyn, how much of it is driven by this feeling amongst the neocon Zionists that Corbyn would be some sort of barrier to what they plan for Iran? What do you think?
Well, look, first question, with Putin and
Netanyahu regularly,
you keep your friends close and your enemies closer, don't you? So he realises that the relationship between Russia and Israel is absolutely key to, you know, Russia is treading on eggshells as the Russian armed forces intervene in Syria. So that's one of the reasons I think that Putin is quite rightly saying, well, we need to make sure that our relationship with Israel is absolutely as close as possible, because potentially we might have to go to war with them. And that doesn't mean to say, you know, he's a very mature politician, I think. He's not the sort of person, well, I don't like this country, like the West seem to do. You know, we don't like this country, let's put them in a box marked trouble and just be nasty to them. You know, Putin's doing that, and he realises, I think, he's got to have a good relationship with Netanyahu just in case war breaks out. With Corbyn, I mean, we do disagree on him to a certain extent. I don't necessarily think his whole program saying I don't believe in Brexit anymore, which he seems to have slowly had his arm twisted round by the rest of the parliamentary party to do, is even genuine, Richie. I think he could even simply be waiting for the Conservative Party to make a massive mess of Brexit in order to gain political capital out of it. I wouldn't say that's necessarily a bad tactic, because he may then win a general election on the back of it. So you can see why he might be doing that. But he's definitely genuine about Palestine. He's one of those people that really does understand, the injustice that's been done to the Palestinian people. And I don't think it's going to be possible to really get Corbyn to be a pro Netanyahu, pro Likud, pro Israel supporter, or a friend of Israel. But I had an interview with a guy called Anton Chaykin a couple of weeks ago, and he was a great guy. I wasn't even sure he was still alive, but he is, and he's the son of the Jacob Chaykin, who was the strategist and the lawyer for the Nazi boycott in the United States, the Jewish boycott in the US of Nazi Germany in the World War II. And Anton Chaykin was saying to me, I mean, this is amazing, really. He's comparing what's going on in the Labour Party to what was going on in the Jewish community in the United States, because there were very, very powerful Jews who were funded by Kuhnlohe Bank to be pro-Nazi. And they were making a big fuss about how wonderful Hitler was and how useful he was at stopping the Bolsheviks, blah, blah. And he said most of the Jews obviously realized what Hitler was up to. This is way back in 1933 when Hitler was first elected. They organized a boycott against Nazi Germany. He was elected, wasn't he? And this is before, and Anton pointed out, this is before Hitler got any power and arms and an army or anything. This other Jewish faction, led by Kuhnlohe Bank, they overturned the boycott. They broke the boycott. And he was comparing what's going on with Corbyn now to those situations then, where you've got different factions, within the Jewish community. That is Zionist factions, or, I would call them the sort of learned Jews from Europe over the centuries who's picked up much brilliant, independent-minded stuff from, not only from their own faith, but from their interaction with the local community, from government, etc., from just having their own community and their own independent minds. They decided that they had to draw a line when Hitler was brought to power, but that was undermined by other Jews who were more interested in the money. And he was comparing that to today, which I think is a brilliant comparison to make, and something I haven't seen anyone on the BBC even really acknowledge, that there's a strong Jewish faction in Britain, which there certainly is in Bristol. Many of the Jews I speak to in Bristol are, disgusted to see the way that Corbyn has been being smeared.
But Corbyn is doing nothing for himself, Tony. You see, this, we keep coming back to this, and I do with other guests as well. Here you have a guy who did an interview with Sophie Ridge for Sky News last week. I think it aired on Sunday morning. And Ridge presents him with an open goal. She asks him about the Panorama feature about anti-Semitism. And Corbyn knows that Panorama used people who allegedly worked for the Labour Party to denounce him and his closest aides as interfering in, having interfered in cases of anti-Semitism. They denounced them. Some of them made unsubstantiated claims that they were abused and ridiculed and called names. And only two of them turned out to have been featured in the Al Jazeera show, The Lobby, which unmasked Joan Ryan taking bribes from an Israeli embassy staffer. And in that lobby,
Shai Massoff.
So Corbyn is sitting there.
Kicked out of the country.
Yes, and Corbyn is sitting there, and he knows that some of the people that the BBC put on camera, in front of the camera, on their Panorama show, he knows that they were intimately connected to the Israeli embassy and to the attempt to undermine anti-Israeli or pro-Palestinian politician, and Corbyn just sits there. Corbyn is not going to do anything. We'll never leave the European Union because the elites will never allow that. Corbyn is genuinely anti-European Union to his bone, but is never going to say it ever again. He's completely hijacking. I think Gilad Atzmon has written some amazing stuff on what's happened to Corbyn. Corbyn is a non-entity. Well, he's right though. It's shocking to see that.
Yes,
right?
To a certain extent, yes, he is. But the thing is with Corbyn, I think he's trying to please everybody, which is almost an impossible thing to do. It's like he's in a situation where he should have realised, give him an inch, they'll take a mile. But we ought to talk about the Carl Beach thing as well, because this is enormous, isn't it?
Well, it's enormous, right? Look, Harvey Proctor has been on every television channel today, saying
yeah, the
that.
The convicted sex offender, Harvey Proctor.
The convicted sex offender, that's right.
Underneath his name, you know, underneath convicted sex offender, Harvey Proctor. Every time he appears, those words should be with his name.
Now hang on, he would argue. Yes, hang on, he would argue that he had consensual sex with 17-year-olds when the age of consent was 21. He would say it wasn't fair. You shouldn't consider me a sex offender, he would say.
Yes, but those people that testified against him said that he was a sadist, that he got all this sexual pleasure out of beating young boys. I mean, this was all part of the case which he was convicted. So yeah, we can't just brush that under the carpet. You know, so the Carl Beach thing, really, to me, is pretty horrific looking at it. It's one of the undisputable aspects of it is it's bound to have a chilling effect both on the police and on survivors of child sexual abuse,
yes,
which is not really what you'd expect any decent government or decent inquiry or decent police force or decent press would want to happen. So, you know, I mean, the idea that this guy, he's being talked about as starting a witch hunt. Well, I wonder whether the witch hunt isn't also for him. I mean, the guy's clearly been involved in his younger years in difficult circumstances of one sort or another. We can't necessarily say what and what not, because clearly he was to a certain extent a fantasist. But certainly, look, Richie, the guy's psychologically damaged. And I would look at it as a kind of MK Ultra style manipulation that's been done of him. You know, a vulnerable guy, basically. And we on our program said this exactly 2 or 3 years ago, that he's vulnerable. You can't necessarily trust everything he said, but at that point they were believing and trusting, the police were, and the authorities, everything. And we said at the time, this looks to us as if he's being set up. He's been set up as a patsy. That was 2 or 3 years ago we said that. Now he's due to do 18 years in prison. Okay, remember Theresa May, it's her child sex abuse inquiry she set up that's led to this, really, and all the publicity and the civil service around it. Lyle Goddard, who was one of the best potential chairs of that committee, had to resign because she could not choose her staff. The staff were being given to her, forced on her by the Home Office, which was itself under investigation for facilitating child sexual abuse. And so she said, well, how on earth am I supposed to work with staff who are actually the suspects in this inquiry? And she quite rightly went. But the inquiry has gone on ever since with the lady from Rotherham, Alexis Jay, who actually got nothing done in Rotherham apart from had a big hoo-ha, but nobody was prosecuted. None of the police were prosecuted. None of the social workers were prosecuted. None of the local authority officials were prosecuted in Rotherham. So she seems like the perfect person for a whitewash. And if you compare the 18 years in jail that Carl Beach is having to do, it was called Nick, wasn't he?
Yeah,
You know, look, there was a fascinating case just a couple of weeks ago of Youssef Mackey, you may remember in Manchester, a grammar school pupil, who was stabbed in the heart and murdered, well, apparently not murdered, and he's 17 years old in Hale Barnes.
Hale Barnes,
which is
yeah.
Part of Manchester.
Very posh, yeah.
By a 17-year-old boy, who is just only known as Boy A. He successfully argued that I stabbed him in the heart in self-defense, where this guy apparently had pushed him, and the three kids, him, the 17-year-olds, had planned to rob a drug dealer, and that never worked out.
But of course, it's
all the testimony from Boy A and Boy B, these 17-year-olds that can't even be named. Not only that, the guy Boy A, after this verdict, saying he wasn't guilty of murder and wasn't guilty of manslaughter, he released a stabbing motion video. So it's a motion of himself doing a stabbing action with his hand, which was then circulated to the victim's family. And he's going to do a maximum of 8 months if he is on good behaviour, and then he'll be released. And he didn't murder anybody. He didn't. There's no manslaughter. So compare this with Carl Beach. Here's someone who's come forward, who's vulnerable, and he's talked about being sexually abused. Well, maybe he's, you know, said the wrong thing. Maybe he's been encouraged to say the wrong thing. Maybe he's been manipulated. He has to go to jail for 18 years as a whistleblower for child sexual abuse. Oh, but a so-called non-murderer gets 8 months. And no wonder the father of Youssef Maki, who died back in May, I think it was this year, is angry, because there's no justice in these sorts of decisions whatsoever, Richie.
He was, he's quite rightly outraged. And there's, you know, a lot of people in this part of the world who believe that the family status and money and contacts and connections have basically left him, you know, I would say, basically get away with it. Just finally, because he's got about 2 minutes left, we're approaching the top of the hour. Tony Gosling, thisweek.org.uk, the politics show on BCFM. Finally on Beach, the logical conclusion is, you've said it yourselves there, that mud was thrown at some innocent people, at some not so quite innocent people, but not monsters either, maybe, not to muddy the waters, but to give the public the impression that it's all nonsense when we know it isn't, but also to dissuade police officers and detectives from following it up in the future. I mean, Richard Henriquez has come out today and said that there should be a criminal investigation and some of these detectives should face criminal charges. So basically warn people to stay away from it and get the public thinking that it's all nonsense.
Well, the justice system has been bought. That's what's happened, I think, because money has been thrown at lawyers on behalf of Harvey Proctor and various other people in order to make an example of Carl Beach and to send a very, very clear message. Because, of course, the clear message that was sent out after the Jimmy Savile scandal, which itself, there was a massive attempt to cover that up initially, and it was only the Oldie magazine that published an article about it. Nobody else would publish, not Private Eye and Ian Hislop and that lot. They said, no, we're not interested in this story. Biggest story of the decade, and so there was a massive message went out to the police and to the public that we're going to start taking child sexual abuse seriously. What's happened with this Carl Beach case and Harvey Proctor going on the TV saying, look, I've won, is total opposite effect. It means that that those who are whistleblowers, potential whistleblowers, people who've been abused, survivors, are going to be thinking, God, I don't want to end up with 18 years in jail. I better shut up. I better not go to the police. And the same sort of thing with police. And remember Gordon Anglesey. I don't know if you remember him from North Wales. He was the guy who was, he got loads of, I think it was £250,000-£300,000 in compensation from the newspapers, said that they smeared him, that he was a paedophile, and all the papers had to apologise, and he got a massive payout, and everyone was talking about him as the victim. It turned out he really was a paedophile. And he had to go to jail afterwards, and he died after, I think it was like 3 weeks in jail. So the Gordon Anglesey case should teach us that perhaps Harvey Proctor may have won this case, but it may not absolutely and ultimately guarantee the truth of that case, and also, you know, Carl Beach may appeal, and it may turn out that some of the people that he was making allegations against were paedophiles. So one legal case may send out a massive message in order to stifle debate, stifle for people from coming forward, but that may only last for a certain amount of time, as in the case of Gordon Anglesey, Richie.
Brilliant, Tony. We could have spoken about Jeffrey Epstein, but we'll get into that another time. We're watching that closely as well. Listen, always great to have you on, folks. Thisweek.org.uk. If you haven't before, I know you have, but if you haven't, check out Tony's programme. There's not very much like it, to be honest, on the radio in this country today. Thanks, mate, for your help as always. I know we'll be doing this again real soon. Cheers, T.
Cheers, Richie, and God bless to all your listeners.
You too, mate. The brilliant Tony Gosling, live on the line from Bristol this afternoon. Thisweek.org.uk is the website there.